Alright, time for another draft physics video presentation. Bill Gates. So we'll do, Bill is he's a good scientist in the sense that he is careful. He doesn't assert he's right, he just asserts it makes sense to him, blah, blah, blah. He likes first principles, he likes the idea that the logic has to incorporate all that's what we know. You have to take all the facts and make them all fit, blah, 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 stuff like that, good stuff. He says some things about experiments and other things that he doesn't like, and I don't, you know, he doesn't think experiments are all that, and I'm thinking, well, no, experiments are pretty much everything. It makes assertions that I just don't agree with, that, we'll never see the fundamental mechanism. And sure we will. Once we understand it and understand what we're looking for, then we're more likely to be able to invent some sort of device that can measure that quantity. They say they're detecting neutrinos and all kinds of wacky shit. That's incredibly, discreet and tiny. And, it's probably bad to bring that up just because, yeah, that's such bad physics. Their claims are such monstrous perversions of reality. Is who knows what they're detecting, actually. Anyway, so he does a lot of good contextualizing of the history of physics and, debunking some of the standard jargon and bullshit that's stated as if it's a fact when it's not a fact, that kind of stuff. So in this video, he's dealing with force, mostly gravity, and some of the history of it. Now, the part he left out was pretty much after Newton, the whole de Chatelet revitalization of Leibniz's energy theory, the mv squared, and the fact that that was the foundation of much of what Einstein did, was the existence of this squaring of velocities. And that's something that, in my opinion, there's no good evidence. So here's where experiments fail dismally, where they declared things without any good experimental evidence, and that's where it's really dangerous. It starts with this statement about Newton, and I just want to do this for my own purposes, that this is to my own advantages. In the sense, at least, there's some verification by Bill that Newton didn't say F equals ma, that this is all just crap they say, and it's, I don't think Newton would want that put on his tombstone. It wasn't what he said, and what he said is a much simpler statement, and it's certainly, Newton was smart enough to know, you know, if acceleration is a rate, you can't multiply times a rate. The rate at which something's happening, you can't multiply by a rate, because the rate can only happen in a certain amount of time. Now, obviously, we're always in gravity. So you can write a mathematical equation with a rate in it about gravity, because we're always in it for the purpose of any statement made about your existence on Earth. Now, if we were going to write a formula about what happens to you when you move from the Earth to the Moon, well, then we know we would change that equation. But even then, we're still in gravity. So you never escape the Earth's gravity. So rate can make a sense when you're talking about a force that is continuous and inescapable. But if you're talking about forces that happen between two objects, the multiplying a cue ball times the rate of its acceleration based on it having contact with something, the rate only means something in the sense that it only happens for a tiny period of time while the change is taking place. So if you don't have that time in there, there's no way to multiply times the rate. On its face, it's not very logical. It can be figured out that that's not a real formula. Nothing can equal mass times a rate. Like I said, it can't make any sense ever. Okay, the rate somebody tell you the rate of the rain. So they're going to tell you how much rain you collect by saying The rain's falling at 1 inch per hour. Okay, so I multiply, my umbrella, the size of the bucket I'm carrying, times the rate that the rain is falling, and I don't put any time limit on how long the bucket's in the rate. So how can I multiply that? How can I get a rational answer? Well, the answer is you can't. Okay. So they change what acceleration even means, as they transform their formulas. They don't have a consistent definition. Now, he sort of points that out in the sense that he points out that their definition on gravity, the force equals, and then force F equals ma, these two equations are measured by different things, that your distance in gravity between two objects is a real distance, an amount of space between two objects, where the distance in the acceleration question is more the distance you traveled, which is a different distance. But anyway, so leave us play some of this and get to the key points that I find useful. So in context, I contacted Bill years ago, tried to provoke a conversation between us, but there's just no conversation because he's just going to argue rope theory, and I'm not really interested in arguing rope theory. I am interested in arguing elemental functions in the universe, whether there's an ether or whether there has to be forces and all of that stuff. The premise of his idea is that every elemental particle in the universe is connected to every other particle by a physical mechanism, a rope, a string, a connecting device. And you're just saying, well, what's the connecting device made out of? Is it hair? Is it scales? Is it, is it full of atoms? It just doesn't make any sense that the elemental function could be something that's a complex machine. And I don't know how you make a rope that travels billions of light years across space that isn't a complex machine. And it's so much simpler for me to just say, no, the universe is stones. It's just stones banging around. We see it happening right now. There's asteroids flying around. They hit things. The universe is just throwing shit. Okay? It's just blobs of shit being thrown. They have momentum. They impart their momentum. They transfer it to the objects they hit. And that's what's really happening. There's no ropes anywhere. But anyway, so it's really kind of just a stifling point. Frankly, I could suspend having to argue my explicit statements about there's no ether and there's, no way that things are connected by mechanisms. They're connected by interactions. A star throws photons at us, and it takes a long time for the photons to get here, the rocks. So I'm just saying, for whatever reason, it's just impossible for us to interact in any way Bill finds useful. I think the conversations would be useful, but it apparently ain't going to happen.
Did not come up with this notion over here.
All right, so I have him sped up and obviously too low. So Newton did not, he's saying. So the point is that the modern F equals ma form of Newton's second law does not appear in any edition of Principia. So point is it's not what Newton said. Now, what Newton did say was F equals the change in your momentum divided by a unit of time, if you want to use one. So if you want to know what the rate of the forces, you can know it as a rate by putting per second or per minute or per hour. You could put a number in and you would know what the rate is per hour. Again, the Principia was focused on gravity. Gravity was the big story in Newton's book, but the big story has the elemental story in it. So it has momentum in it. Momentum's a big part of what it's telling, the story it's telling. The momentum of the objects in the universe and how they interact with each other based on how this force that mediates their interactions affects them. the force field, you could say. You could say it that way, anyway. So he has the the English version, okay, a translation. All right, a change in motion is proportional to the motive force impressed. So the word proportional is the one that's debatable, right? Because you could argue that his F equals change in momentum over time is basically saying it's not proportional, it's explicit. The change in the motion is going to be equal to the motive force impressed. The force will be equal to the change in the momentum. So it's really just, you're just saying momentum is going to change momentum. Force has momentum. Force will cause a change in the momentum of the object. There'll be a transfer of the momentum. And takes place along straight line in which the force was impressed. Now, see, that's kind of deceptive because he's not really saying it all continues in a straight line. He's saying the force is a vector in a straight line. The momentum the object already has is a vector in a straight line. And the two vectors will intersect to create a new straight line. But, you know, you have to write more into the statement. So this whole idea of trying to make everything simple sometimes just breaks the concept itself. A couple of more sentences probably would have been required to make this more explicit and more accurate. So we'll play some of Bill.
Times acceleration. Force equals mass times acceleration. You won't find it in his book. It's not in it. Yeah, yeah. What Newton said, essentially, a change in motion is proportional to the motive force impressed and takes place along the straight line in which that force is impressed.
So motive force is momentum, put simply. And that's all he's saying. He's just saying momentum causes momentum. So if something doesn't have any motion and something hits it, there'll be only the momentum of the thing that's hitting, and it'll always be conserved, and it's just a matter of what percentage of its force did it give to the object. And you'll tell how much force it gave by just measuring how much momentum it has. So you don't need any of this mv squared stuff. So I wish Bill took this the next step, which is to get to the mv squared stuff, to get to the real, where the real perversion of Newton took place. So the significance of them converting from F equals change in momentum over time, perverting that formula into F equals ma, the very reason for it is to justify their derivations to create the kinetic energy formula, you know, where they're saying, okay, that the energy, the force, somehow equals, one half mv squared, which there's no evidence that it does. All right, so we'll just jump a little. Well, let's go just here, see what he says, and then I'll try to jump.
And from that, the French men who got a hold of his book said, force equals mass times acceleration. It wasn't Newton who came up with that equation, but that's essentially what he insinuated, and that's what we learned today. We say,
So he didn't insinuate it, and so let's just say, no, he didn't. He didn't say anything. He didn't contrive anything called a rate of acceleration. He talked about a change in velocity, okay? So, and a change in velocity means you go from 30 miles an hour to 60 miles an hour. Not that you go increase your velocity by 10 miles an hour for 6 units. That's not what he's saying. So to him, it's a total change in your, all those things are total changes. The total force equals the total change in your momentum. It's not what rate you're changing. Rate is irrelevant.
Second law. Okay? How about gravity? I mean, Newton's famous for gravity, right? Let's find out what Newton proposed on gravity.
So I think Bill misunderstands this statement, because I think it's clear what Newton is saying is that, yes, I don't have an explanation for the thing, the cause of gravity. But what I do have, okay, is a statement for you that it's not magic. Newton's saying, whatever the cause is, there's something causing it, okay? There's a something behind it, not a nothing, a something, okay? It's not just magically without any, you know, without any mechanism moving. Okay, stuff is moving for a reason. So he's just adding that piece of logic that I would say, what I would intuitively also argue, that there's no reason to believe the physical universe contains non-physical magical elements.
Here you see it. Okay. This is what he wrote in Principia, two places, in section 12 and section 13.
Okay, so in this part he's saying that the idea that Newton is using of the inverse square law is, first of all, something he plagiarized, and that second of all, it's not all that. But to me, this is the key to understanding gravity is the inverse square law. It is the significant fact. And the most significant part of the fact is that I could argue to you quite obviously that an explosion on Earth is a little bit broken, but you can get the idea. If an explosion in space, we explode something, it's the inverse square law. The pieces of the explosion will hit you by the inverse square law. Closer you are, it's four times more. My hand is doing it, right? I mean, I've done this so many times, but hand here. Half the distance, four times bigger hand. This hand is four times bigger than this hand, even though it's half the distance. And gravity's doing the same thing. And light from a light bulb is doing the same thing. Your camera is absorbing light, the same rules. It's all over the place, the inverse square law. It is the rule of how whatever it is, a force going out or a force coming in, how it's experienced. It's really fundamental. And the fact that there's this huge connection between what light's doing, light from the sun, is the inverse square law. It's hitting the universe by the inverse square law. It's doing exactly what this hand is doing. It's the same rule. And here it is, an outward force. And so you're just saying gravity's doing the same thing in reverse. So all you have to do is come up with a reverse mechanism. So instead of the idea that something's exploding, leaving, energy's leaving an object, you could sort of understand somehow the Earth is consuming energy. Somehow it's consuming stuff coming in from the outside at the same rate a sun produces energy, at the same consistency, the same spherical consistency. And I would argue that, yeah, you could just understand it that to push matter, to push electrons and protons, you consume energy, and that consumption of energy is the same as the production of light. It's indestructible logically. Logically, it works and it fits and it's indestructible as a possible explanation. You're not going to find any flaw in it. Now, it could be wrong, could be that it's not the answer. But the fact is, you can't break it. It works as an explanation.
He essentially was doing theorems. He was trying to prove certain things. Okay, so he says, I say that a corpuscle put in a place outside the surface of the sphere is attracted to the center of the sphere by a force inversely proportional to the square of its distance from the same center.
Right, okay, so this isn't really an important argument. This is just basically saying, okay, somebody else said it first. Who cares? All these guys said, Galileo said, I stand on the shoulders of giants. Newton said, I stand on the shoulders of giants. This idea that everybody has to give attribution to everybody else, it creates a lot of problems. Because guess what? The guy who said it before you, he might have heard it from somebody else. And so then you have to attribute even further. You know, it just gets pretty complicated if, you know, how somebody fell upon it. The guy would have to admit, well, I got half the answer from this guy, and I got a quarter of the answer from that guy, and I got eighth of the answer from that guy. So kind of a waste of time.
And then because he...
All right, let me just jump ahead a little.
Because Hooke did not come up with an equation. He had no...
So this is the argument that... So Newton had his calculus stolen by Leibniz, and then Hooke was making the accusation that Newton stole his theories. And again, if you go through how this was debated and tried, frankly, Newton comes off pretty clean, but whatever.
He did not prove it. He just guessed at it. He had a hunch that it was true.
Obviously, there was a lot of people who wanted to steal off of Newton because Newton was God, you know. They all wanted to steal some of the God power.
Whereas Newton was able to show in his book, that it was true. You know, that was that it was exactly the case.
Well, what he proved in his book is that it worked, okay, as an explanation and solved all of the riddles of why did certain things happen, you know, in space when you looked at moons and stuff and they always showed up and there was irregularities and there was this and that. It answered all of the irregularities that existed and all the unanswered questions about the motion of the celestial bodies. And so the fact that it answered those questions was fairly impressive as a piece of evidence that it's a good theory.
And so it was a difference between one guy believing it and the other guy proving it, so to speak. And so Newton says, you know, I'm not going to give credit to Hooke, even if he did mention that to me, okay, because Hooke never proved it. And there were other people who also talked about the square of the distance before Newton.
Well, yeah, of course. And so that's the whole point, though, isn't it? Is that it's pretty obvious, right? It's a pretty simple principle, right? And to give attribution is like giving attribution to the round wheel. I mean, this is an observation that's not all that hard to realize. You're just talking about the fact that you're recognizing that it's a very proportional contraction, just like a very proportional expansion, and that the rule of those things is it will be inverse because it's spherical. The reason why it's an inverse square law is because it's a round object. That's what's causing the inverse square law, is because the circumference of a sphere gets four times bigger as you make it twice as the, you know, you double the diameter, you quadruple the size of the circumference. So that's the reason why this means something, is because of what spheres do. And obviously, this whole idea is that there's a center of gravity, again, implying a sphere, just like an explosion out implies a sphere.
The only thing Newton gave there is this mathematical certitude, you know, where he says it is true.
Well, it isn't even mathematical certitude in the sense that it's just saying that this mathematical relationship will give you a right answer. It will tell you why the moon is, you know, the orbit of the moon and the velocity of the moon and why the moon stays where it is and all that stuff. It will explain the orbit. So if you use this figure with this gravitational constant, this equation will give you the right answer.
Okay? So essentially he proved it through these theorems that he wrote in his book. Okay? So just keep in mind that how things really develop. Not everyone who is credited with having discovered something was the actual discoverer.
So again, it really just doesn't matter much. Okay? I say it matters, but it doesn't matter much. And I'm saying that I don't think these guys were all that big on the thief thing, in the sense when you say something like I stand on the shoulders of giants, you're making a concession, a pretty overt and loud concession that, yeah, I wasn't the only guy in the war. You know, all those other guys, whatever their names are, yeah, there's lots of them. They did work too. But there's no point in saying Newton didn't earn his prestige as a scientist, because he only spent like every waking moment of his existence doing science. I mean, he was, you could call it a little bit obsessed, right? I mean, he really didn't live any other life than the life of melt this, add these ingredients. I mean, he did all kinds of alchemy. He did all kinds of stuff, but his whole life was doing this stuff. I mean, he spent such a tiny percentage of his life sitting on his ass, twiddling thumbs. Never had sex, never, you know, not, he just didn't have any distractions. He was kind of a one science, I mean, he was just, I'm just saying you can't deny him the fact that those hours of work did produce products.
There was someone who preceded him, who came up with the idea, and this guy just developed it further and, you know, fine-tuned it. And Newton is credited primarily for mathematizing it, and that's more or less what he also said, the same thing. Galileo mathematized it, or proved it, you know, kind of put it in right.
See, I don't think that's the right way to say it. I don't think it's really just about the mathematics as it is about the concept. And so, frankly, I don't see anything. The inverse square law being demonstrated to be the correct interpretation of how the force acts, establishing that without doubt, it was an important thing to do.
Rational terms, so to speak. Okay, so that's where the difference is. It's not like Galileo came up with these ideas or Newton came up with these ideas. These ideas were already on the books. Okay, but what Newton did not discover was the following. One of the things, okay, there's a couple. This is the first one. He didn't discover that his force equals mass times acceleration, if we're going to give him credit for that.
Okay, so he's just making these comparisons. This is where math really breaks down. So I agree with Bill that math is crap if you're going to do this kind of shit. So the idea that these two forces are in the same context is idiotic. You can't combine them. Because this F equals this equation in one circumstance doesn't mean that this F is the same F in this circumstance, and therefore I can say MA equals G M1 M2 divided by R squared. I don't know why I have distance squared, but whatever.
Had to do with push and his gravitational equation, force equals...
The obvious thing they should have figured out is that the sunlight coming from the sun is exactly the opposite of gravity. So if you could make a parallel, it has every feature, every functional feature, the push force of the energy coming out of the sun, has every aspect of the functionality of gravity, except it's backwards. So it's pushing out, and that's the only difference. If it was a pulling in, if the light somehow got sucked in by an explosion, if it was an implosion, implosions aren't really implosions, then it would be gravity. That would have been, to me, a very useful contextual insight somewhere in here. Because very shortly after, Maxwell was going to establish pretty much the speed of the other forces and light, and by establishing that, you pretty much establish that gravity's doing the same thing. Because it's working based on the same relationship, that it takes time for gravity to get from one object to another object. And once you establish that gravity has the same speed as photons, oh come on, it's getting kind of obvious that all gravity is the consumption of photons. You're consuming energy somehow. And all you have to do is figure out how you would consume energy, where it went. And obviously I have pointed out that if you understand that the force is moving much slower when it's pushing electrons, then you can understand that's where the energy is missing. Energy in the universe was consumed because forces moving the speed of light didn't move the speed of light when they're pushing electrons. So places where electrons are and they need to be pushed are places that have a deficit in energy. They're radiating out less energy than's coming in because they're moving a bunch of matter. And the price for moving the matter is you radiate less energy than came into you.
A gravitational constant G, mass 1, mass 2, divided by distance squared, that's pull. Okay.
All right, so I don't think this conversation is terribly useful, so I'll just jump ahead a little bit.
You can't do physics with concepts, okay? This is very important. And here you see, he writes to
Richter. So I think, of course, you can do physics with concepts. That's all you really did, and you're just calling it an axiom or a starting point or whatever you want to call it, but it's still just a concept of rope. I would say that concept is broken in the sense that the concept isn't elemental enough. And that you want to get elemental about how you communicate in the universe. How do I affect a change somewhere? Well, the easiest way to affect a change is to throw a piece of change. Throw it. Okay? It's the simplest mechanism in the universe is just throw it. No dominoes, no infrastructure. Just throw the rock. And so, yeah, the photons are made out of rocks, rocks at a frequency. Gravity is rocks without a frequency, Charge is blue and red rocks. Not that complicated when you really break it down to what is, what the universe has every appearance of being. Again, you got to understand the big universe with all that empty space and the hunks of crap spinning around each other and whacking into each other. It is a parallel. It's the same universe as the one where the little frickin' electrons and protons are in. The same empty space. The theme of the empty space with junk in it is not a bad theme. It's not something where you should look at it and say, hey, it's trying to fool me. No, that's probably a good illustration of the basic idea that how do things communicate? Well, they throw something at each other. And some stuff takes a really long time to get there.
Mr. Bentley, fellow who looked up to him because he was such a great mathematician, and he writes to him in 1693, he says, that gravity should act without the mediation of anything else is to...
Okay, so they did take out some blah, 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 okay? So without the mediation of anything else. So he's saying there has to be a mediator. There has to be. Okay, he's saying there has to be some mechanism. So it would be absurd for there to be no mechanism. So it's too bad they took out the rest because it probably makes it more clear that what he's saying is the idea that it just happens is silly. The idea that, you know, little x-ray vision or something, you know, the... No. ESP isn't causing the Earth to make a satellite orbit. You know, there's got to be a physical mechanism.
Be so great an absurdity that I believe no man who has, in philosophical matters, a competent faculty of thinking can ever fall into it.
Right. So he's basically saying, he's pre-Einstein, he's saying... Einstein's going to show up, and I think it's absurd, because he's going to give you a nothing mechanism. Nothing. A bent geodesic. It's made out of nothing, and it's some kind of nothing thing, and somehow all the matter in the universe knows it's supposed to go where the nothing told it to go. I mean, it's a competent faculty of thinking can never fall for it, yes. Somebody logical ain't going to fall for it. But I'd also say to Bill, they ain't going to fall for no stringy rope crap either, because that's way too much mechanism. That's claiming, oh, we've solved the universe by finding the elemental string. And we would know, well, now we got to explain the string, because obviously it's got to be made out of atoms, right? It's got to be made out of something. What's the string made out of? Magical eyeball energy? I mean, what, you know, what's it made out of? Laser beamy, stuffy, maybe kind of whatever. Yeah, come on. So you're building a whole new universe to explain the universe of the string.
Newton could not explain why an object is attracted to another gravitationally, why the Earth is attracted to the sun.
Right, but he had lots of ideas. So again, so we can go all the way back to, you know, the mock gravity argument was made. Okay, what's his face? I forgot his name, unfortunately. Poor little French guy who suggested it, and then Lesage, you know, stole it later. You know, well, he bought it, actually. Let's not say he didn't steal the idea. He actually paid for the other guy's papers, you know. I mean, he paid his family for the papers to, you know, rebuild his gravity model. So Newton knew of it. He liked it. And they found some problems, and that's the whole point, right? That's the whole idea, is to find a way to break something. That's how you test it. You smash it around and you see if you can break it. But you've got to recognize that sometimes you break it for... you know, for reasons that are knowable, that of course it's going to be vulnerable to be broken. The reason why Einstein's theory isn't breakable, okay, is because there isn't any mechanism. It doesn't have to do anything else. Just like dark matter, you can't defeat dark matter because it's perfect. It's an invisible man theory. How do I break the invisible man theory? I mean, he's invisible. You can't see him, so I can't point out how he doesn't exist, showing how he doesn't exist in the picture. There's no way to falsify or to critique, because it doesn't do anything but the one specific thing you want to do. So you create your bent geodesic that has no other symptom in the universe. It's only doing one thing for no rational reason. It's pulling into the Earth for no good reason, no mechanism, no cause, no effect, no anything. It just happens. Yeah, you can't defeat that because there's, you know, it's perfectly elusive. It's perfectly, it doesn't have a, like I said, the dark matter thing would fail if you had to give that matter reality. That is, you had to make it, oh, it reflects light. Oh, it's, you know, something it's opaque to. So if it had to obey a single one of the real rational rules that all the other matter has to obey, then it would give itself away as being falsifiable. But because it's made out of imaginary stuff, it doesn't have to obey any rules. So anyway, but that's basically what Newton was saying, is that, look, when you're going to find the answer, it's not going to be... Yeah, that's not going to... Gravity's not going... It's not going to be a woo answer.
Son, why the moon is attracted to the Earth. He could describe and tell you the relation, the mathematical relation, square of the distance.
Right. Well, I'm just saying that he did go through thinking about all this and you know, what are the alternatives? And so, like I said, he liked mock gravity. He liked it. Yes, it works. Okay, but he also recognized that, well, yes, but now it makes all these complications about all these transfers of energy, and I'm going to have too much energy in the object. You know, the problem was is that the energy goes in. He didn't really think of any mechanism that was possible to actually make the energy disappear. How do you consume it? How do you use it? Where do you shoot it off to? But Einstein had exactly the same problem, and no one cared. He has a gravity well. The well is infinite, and it doesn't. The stuff in the bottom of the well never pops back out into the universe. So, I mean, it is another, you know, if you just rephrase the theories a little bit, you can point out that these are huge flaws. So, yeah, Newton didn't have any certainty. I think he certainly had preferences.
But he could not tell you why. What was causing gravity? And then he essentially confesses that he has no clue whatsoever. Why? Because he did math and he did not do physics. He was a mathematician, not a physicist.
All right, so I think that's just really bullshit to say. He sat there and ground his own lenses. The guy, you know, come on. He's a physicist. He's a scientist in every respect. And he wasn't a mathematician. He knew math was a formulation, a simplification. If you wanted to describe a complex system, you had to find out what are the key elements making something happen, and that you can take these small number of elements and then you can predict what will happen in the big system if you get all the variables into your math. Now, that's logical, Bill. I mean, to sit there and trash all mathematics is bullshit.
Okay, and unfortunately, what we have today is a branch that came out of Newton and Galileo and went into mathematical physics, and they keep doing equations, they keep doing explanations.
But their explanations aren't any good, so they keep doing equations, don't get right answers. Again, the analysis by Young of the double slit, the math doesn't work, okay? Physically doesn't actually work. The wave mathematics doesn't work. It doesn't produce the right answer, and they haven't even conceded that. F equals MA. I mean... You know, E equals, one-half mv squared, a completely unproven mathematical theory. Absolutely no real evidence saying this is true at all. There's no evidence it takes four times more gas to go 60 miles an hour than 30. No evidence.
Physical interpretations using concepts like mass and force and field, you know, instead of using objects, physical objects.
Those are objects, so I guess I would argue again that an ether would be an object, a field would be an object. Yeah, you know, that's okay. The use of the word as some placeholder for a mechanism, as long as you know the field moves at a certain speed, that whatever it is that has momentum, then what's the big deal saying a field of light? You know, of course, that's exactly what it is. It's a bunch of stuff with momentum heading for you, moving at a rate. There's nothing terribly horrible about saying something like that, in my opinion.
And here you see from Mr. Galileo what the issue is, okay? And he says the following. He writes this. He says, natural philosophy is written in that great book which ever is before our eyes. I mean, the universe. But we cannot understand it if we do not first learn the language and grasp the symbols in which it is written. The book is written in what? Mathematical language. Okay, this is what...
So there's nothing, again, wrong with this statement. In the sense that you're just saying that it's made of mechanism and the symbols of math are representing the mechanisms, the variables, the things it can do. It can move at a speed. It can have a mass. These are variables that things have. They have conditions, geometric conditions, you know, triangles, circles, other geometrical figures. There's no problem in recognizing that you can take a straight path and make it into a mathematical argument. Anyway, I don't, you know, like I said, I think this is a weak argument. math isn't the problem. It's their underlying assumptions that are the problem. Well, and the fact that they haven't verified the math is a pretty significant problem, that their math is not actually producing right answers.
Gravity here on Earth, all the stuff we have, those are descriptions, mathematical descriptions. We still don't have an idea, mathematicians don't have an idea, what causes this pencil to fall always to the ground. All they have is description, mathematical descriptions.
And it's a very simple experiment, blah, 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 and this force has not been, in my opinion, adequately explained by saying some dopey shit that space is some sort of time-space warpable bullshit, that somehow an electron, being a dumb fucking little piece of shit, can do better than us in terms of seeing the universe. When, oh, come on. It's seeing something? What is it seeing? When it's sitting there in its space, like the moon. It's sitting in its little empty space. You're saying it's seeing something. The moon's not seeing it. Nothing else is seeing it, right? I mean, the pieces of the moon are seeing it. We know that the moon, I could smash the moon with a hammer, you know, from different sides and break it into a bunch of little rocks. As long as I didn't shoot the rocks away, they'd all just stay right there. They're all atoms that are moving around the Earth. It's the individual pieces of the moon that are moving around the moon, right? I could pull all the pieces of the moon off. I could just keep pulling them all off and put them 10 feet away here and put them here. And put them. I could just break it into a bunch of little pieces and they'll do exactly the same thing. I could put one atom where the moon is, and then one atom would do exactly what the moon does. Clearly, the gravity is not happening to the moon. Anyway. And so you're saying the little bits, the little atoms, the little electrons and protons are somehow being told what to do by some sort of magical teller.
You see, mathematics is the language in which God has written the universe. No, absolutely not. The way Mother Nature, God, the devil, all these fellas, right, Father Universe, the way they...
Well, who cares? I don't want to go into that crap. But the fact that there is yin-yang, you know, up, down, left, right, forward, back, and that there's distances and all, you know, that's all mathematically rational. The fact that there's a difference between a triangle and a circle and a sphere and a trapezoid and all this stuff. Yeah, there is. And you can understand the differences in this formalization of mathematical proportions. You know, the side versus, you know, the other side and the angle between the two sides and all of that Pythagorean kind of stuff. It's really useful.
But the universe is with objects, with physical objects. Some of them we cannot see or touch. Others we can see or touch, okay, and touch. But some we cannot. And that's what these people never figured out. You can't do an experiment.
Well, the funny thing is the gravity obviously is touching you, okay? So... it's just figuring out a mechanism to dissect how it's touching you. Now, I'd almost say a photo multiplier, because you can turn it up to make it more and more sensitive, that maybe what you're doing is turning it into a gravity detector. So, you know, we might be having ways of detecting gravity. We're just not recognizing that that's what we're actually detecting. So, no.
To figure out gravity, yeah, you can't do an experiment to figure out gravity. Because there's nothing to see and nothing to touch. So you can go to the lab and do all the experiments you want on gravity. That doesn't mean you're going to come up with...
So there's nothing to see and nothing to touch. But again, we already know that we can see light that we physically can't see. So we can make a camera that can see it. So it's just making the right camera, I guess I would argue. And that doesn't seem to me to be theoretically impossible. It's still always going to be a little bit abstract. Just as our own eyes are an abstraction, we don't actually see photons. The photons cause an electrical response in a field of atoms and blah, blah, blah. It's not as, there's no direct seeing of the energy of a single photon. That doesn't really happen. You're seeing electricity more than you're seeing a photon.
The explanation. You're going to come up with a description, a mathematical description of how fast or what the acceleration is. You can get all that stuff. But what you will never be able to figure out through math or through experiments is how Mother Nature does that trick. For that, you have to make assumptions. Some people make assumptions that there are particles pushing the pencil downwards. Other people say, well, you remove the air between the pencil and the...
Right. We have to try all the available, what can be imagined. as a possible cause. So first we eliminate the stupid causes, like there's a God and he's pushing everything, or there's, you know, little angels who are in slave camps and they have to move every, you know, they have to push these rocks around the universe. You know, you come up with really preposterous, elaborate nonsense stories, or no, what's an elemental explanation? And I guess I would just, again, just say, to me, the obvious starting point is it's doing exactly the opposite of what the sun's doing. So just come up with a mechanism that does exactly the opposite of what the sun's doing. That's the answer. That will be the answer. And I guess another giveaway is that we know in free fall, the key for us feeling a force is the fact that it moves us disproportionately. That is, you'll feel it if it moves your head faster than it moves your stomach or some other thing. Like it's moving parts of your body without moving all of your body. Therefore, you'll feel it because your body isn't moving all at the same speed. And the trick to gravity is that it moves you so perfectly, it moves every bit of you consistently, that you'd never feel gravity. And all we really ever do feel is its absence. So you don't feel weird when you're out of gravity, because the absence of gravity is what's causing you to feel weird. It's the presence of gravity that you've been adapted to. You've been adapted to being pushed up. And it's just that absence of being pushed unevenly. Like if I turn you upside down, you will eventually not like the feeling, because your body isn't made to be upside down in gravity.
Floor, you know, when you remove that, well, then there's a push force again that pushes them together. Maybe the earth upwards or the pencil downwards. Or maybe it's waves pushing the pencil downwards. Or maybe it's ropes pulling it.
So I just say the easiest, simplest analogy is to think of the sun is raining light on the universe. Gravity is raining a force. And there's less pressure pushing you up against it from the earth once you're above the earth. So you have to actually stand on the earth and you can feel the earth pushing you back up against it. That's the competition. That's where there's an equal amount of pressure. But if you're outside of the earth, the surface where the pressure has been compressed, then you're going to fall in the excess rain. I don't know how it's this, you know, probably a better way of saying that.
From the ground. Those are assumptions. You have to make an assumption in order to give a physical interpretation, okay? And math cannot help you at all with that, at all. Okay? All you have with math is descriptions.
Well, you've already had to have the math. You have to have it's a formulization. So you already have to have a right answer. So if you have some wrong answers in your math, that is wrong variables, like for example, the double slit experiment where they only put one variable in, one distance. They have multiple distances in the double slit, right? You have the outside distance, you have the inside distance, you have the distance between the two slits. I mean, the inside surfaces. So you have more than one distance. How come they put one distance in and predict what's going to happen? Yeah, nonsense. Bad equation.
Okay, here's a fellow. His name is Kevin Brown, and he has the math pages. And he tells you essentially what the issues were in the 17th century and where we are today. He does a pretty good summary, so please bear with me, and you'll learn something from this fellow. Okay, he says the following. He says, René Descartes proposed a mechanistic approach to physics. Okay, all causal influence is transmitted by direct contact between material entities.
Right, so that's the only downside for Descartes, is that he was an etherist, so he thought it was all had to be paper. You know, there's not just letters in space. I don't know how to say, you know, that the something, the nothing was something. But the fact is the more important thing stated by Descartes is that the motion is just transferred through everything. Everything's, it's just the same motion. God pushes once and the finger just keeps moving through the universe forever. That's the more important observation. So anyway, so I don't think there's too much in here that's worth bothering with.
to the center or pushing it to the center, you have not given me an explanation. So he's wrong in saying explaining it as that. He can say, yeah, we notice that everything falls to the center of the earth, but we don't know why. So he doesn't have an explanation. He's got a description. And people confuse those two. He says others do repulsion between the very small parts of the body. Okay, these were different theories going around in those days.
Right, so that's what made it confusing. So just at the point when they started to do really good science, you know, you could say the 1700s, whatever, 1600s, they're starting to get this whole science process. They're becoming scientists, building on the shoulders of giants, taking the right answers and piling them up and trying to build a telescope to even righter answers. They got the confusion of the Maxwell problem of they discovered magnetism and charge in the same period, and clearly it just adds a confusion because the gravity explanation isn't going to fit the charge explanation, and you know there's no perfect continuity between them. So yeah, you have now there's more and more. There's a bigger problem because now here you have with charge this obvious, you have attraction and repulsion. You know, and how do you balance that to the obvious difference of gravity, which is there's no such thing as repulsive gravity.
Galileo summarizes those. And while still others attribute it to a certain stress in the surrounding medium, which closes in behind the falling body and drives it from one of its positions to another. Okay, so we have this push gravity. That's what all these people were essentially suggesting, push gravity. Some people have resuscitated push gravity these days.
Yeah, well, again, I would argue, yes, of course, that's exactly what it is. It is push because you've eliminated push from one side. You've degraded the pusher from the other side. So you've used up the push on the other side. You have an imbalance because you've taken some energy out of the force. So every physical material body that has electrons and protons in it that are being jiggled, every time they jiggle in a direction, that is every time they're pushed this way and then they're pushed back this way, they have destroyed energy in this direction and then destroyed energy in this direction, in the sense that the force would have been over here and it only got to here. So if the force was going somewhere, it only got half as far as it should have gone while it was pushing the matter. So obviously the energy in the universe is diminished because obviously it's not moving the speed of light anymore.
I was had a long discussion with Mr. Van Flandern.
Again, all of this is verified by other things, like, you know, the fact that it takes light a lot more time to get through glass. So even though the glass is transparent and you're sort of thinking the light just goes through it, it's clearly not just going through it. It's clearly banging into something. It's clearly being delayed in its progress, which implies, again, a reduction in its energy.
Van Flandern died a few years ago, and he was a push gravity guy. Okay, and this fellow, Kevin Brown, he continues, he says, he talks about Newton here. He says, every two particles of matter are compelled toward each other with a force directly proportional to their masses and inversely as the square of the distance between them. This universal gravitation was apparently contrary to the mechanistic precepts of Descartes.
So again, there's nothing, I mean, I don't see anything contrary to what Descartes was saying. Obviously, Descartes didn't analyze gravity in terms of the inverse square law, so he didn't make an opinion on that. So I don't see anything that disagrees with Descartes.
Because it implied that widely separated bodies exert forces on each other directly without explicit reference to any intervening substance. Okay, so this was the issue. Was there a substance? Was there a material thing between two objects being attracted gravitationally?
So, again, the idea of the substance being something other than a bunch of, you know, energy, bits of rocks. I mean, the substance, the communicator. I mean, you know, people have different visions of what happens when electricity is going through a wire, but frankly, it can be understood as, yeah, electrons are actually moving because they're being pushed by bullets hitting them. You know, and that it's really bullets moving through the wire. It's just the same force as gravity and light and all these other things is the same force moving through the wire.
Disavowed the notion of direct action at a distance because he could not see or touch what was between two objects, okay, especially two celestial objects. Newton's overall approach was that nature consists of atoms moving according to abstract mathematical laws in an empty void.
I don't think that's a good summation of Newton. As Newton was saying, is he believed there was some kind of real mechanism. He didn't know what it was. So what's wrong with him saying that? Yeah, I think it's real. I just don't know what it is. I don't think that's an outrageous statement by Newton. So I just think it's wrong to say it's Newton's overall approach was to say the universe is mathematical. That wasn't what Newton was saying. I think what Newton was saying is the universe is mechanical.
That's a mathematical description, not an explanation. What was Newton? A mathematician. He gave us descriptions. He did not give us explanation.
Well, I'm sorry. He did a lot more than that. I mean, all those lens things and the idea of recognizing all the bent angles and, you know, rainbows. I mean, the guy understood how a rainbow worked, for fuck's sake. I mean, that's a pretty amazing mechanical description. It's not just a mathematical description. He could draw you the picture of it. So again, this is kind of more just, this is harassment. You know, this isn't doing the history right.
And gravity might be a primary attribute of matter with no material intervening mechanism. That was his notion. In other words, the physical explanation.
So I said gravity might be a primary attribute of matter with no material intervening mechanism. I just think Newton was saying exactly the opposite in the other statement. He's obviously saying, in my opinion, he's obviously saying the very idea that you can just imagine that it happens for no reason would be ludicrous. No reasoning man would suggest that it's ESP. There's got to be a mechanism. So I you know, that's just crap to say Newton was saying exactly the opposite, that there just is. It just is. He was saying no, just is a silly answer.
I had no clue about it. He only had a mathematical description. Okay?
Well, so I think you got that part of the history wrong, Bill. Newton was a materialist.
We continue here with this Fowles analysis, math pages. And here are the other people who more or less tried to bring them together, Newton with Descartes. Here we have Huygens, Leibniz, and Bernoulli. And they sought some way of reconciling Newtonian gravity with the mechanical philosophy of Descartes. They sought an explanation of universe.
Well, I don't know if that's what they did, but these are obviously the etherists. So, you know, that's, you know, so they're wavist. I mean, Huygens was the big wavist, you know. So these are people who think the mechanism is built into some sort of underlying mechanism. So like Bill, they believed in some underlying mechanism. Bill believes in ropes, they believed in ether. I believe in rocks.
Yeah. So gravitation in terms of direct contact between what? Material entities. Because
so what is direct contact mean? Again, we know the contact is not direct. You know, in a perfect sense of direct, okay? The sun doesn't produce a photon and instantaneously hits me. There's no direct contact. It's not a hard finger poking. The sun doesn't do that. It throws photonic rocks.
They said, how does Mother Nature do this? We need to have attraction between two objects. There's got to be some material entity that brings them together. There can't be any action at a distance without some intervening object.
That's there you go. Yes, and Newton was saying the same thing, I think. So there's just no, you know, there's obviously a mechanism. Let's find the mechanism.
But they were saying, and they tried to do this, but they couldn't see or touch whatever was between the objects. So I said, tendency for bodies to be drawn together is inherently problematic in the context of Cartesian physics because contact forces are, by definition, directed outward from the surfaces of bodies. Even if...
Well, it's problematic because you know when you're pushing out, you know where it goes. But when you're pushing in, where does it go? You know, where it goes into the middle, and then where does it go? How does it get back out again? How does it get back out into the universe? It destroys the continuity of conservation of energy because the flow doesn't have an explanation. You can explain how you push something together and then it blew back apart. But you can't explain how it just goes in forever. It goes in, and then it never goes back out again. And obviously what I'm arguing is what you're measuring is actually the total energy of a photon, and its total energy is destroyed when it's pushing matter. A portion of its total energy is diminished by pushing matter.
If we hypothesize bodies with hooks or other interconnecting shapes, we must still rely on a force of cohesion to maintain the shapes of the bodies. So we haven't avoided the need for a primitive force of attraction. This shows...
So again, there is no primitive source of attraction, right? So it's a push universe, and attraction is just the absence of the pushback. So if something pushes and you don't push back, that's attraction.
That purely material mechanisms, in the sense of Descartes, are inherently inadequate to fully account for the phenomena of experience, meaning primarily gravity. And yeah, see, this is the issue that we still have today. Because they cannot see, because they cannot touch whatever physical object is between, say, the Earth and the Sun, or between the Moon and the Earth, they say there's nothing there because an object is that which you can see or touch. And no, you're not going to be able to see or touch the mediators Mother Nature uses to do light, gravity, or magnetism. She made them invisible. She made them intangible. We're not going to elucidate.
Blah, 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 blah. So I don't even... All this is unnecessary. Blah, 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 blah. Of course, we can elucidate. Like I said, we have elucidated to some extent photons. We've elucidated to some extent electrons and protons. We've defined to some extent things with pretty certain certitude that charge is a function, that it does happen in the universe, and that it happens between what has every appearance of being material substance, okay, that is positive and negatively charged. And you can change the proportions of the amount of the substance. You make something, you can have give something more electrons, it becomes more negative. You give something more protons, it becomes more positive.
We're not going to reach an understanding of them through equations. We're going to reach them only by, you know, taking a couple beers and visualizing, proposing, making assumptions. That's the only way.
The model is enhanced by all of these things. You see better with math. So you can use math to see the shape of the puzzle piece more clearly. So there's things that make it easier to put the puzzle together. So math is a lubricant for that process. I think it'd be ridiculous to say it doesn't have a lot of use in enhancing your ability to even to make a simulation. You have to use math. If you don't use math, your simulation can't work. Computers need to use the formalization. They need it in the simplest form. So, I mean, you know, there's lots of ways to just argue that it's sort of essential to doing part of the visualizations.
You're going to figure this out, okay? So, you know, all these experiments all these people run are worthless to tell us how Mother Nature runs her shop.
So, again, that's just silly to say experiments are worthless. That's just, I don't even know why you would say this crap. Experiments are brilliant. More the better. Let's do more experiments. Let's just quit doing silly like LIGO ones. You know, they're based on so many propositions of function, so many assertions about what's really happening when they don't necessarily know what's really happening.
They're not going to be able to figure out what's in that invisible, intangible world of hers. Okay.
So I think they are, but whatever, blah, blah, blah.
Hey, so this is essentially what we have here. This was his ending in the math pages. Kevin Brown says, nevertheless, there were many attempts to give a mechanistic account of gravity in terms of contact interaction between what? Material bodies. You want to have a mechanistic interpretation, because otherwise you're not doing physics. That's the issue. These attempts tacitly rely on unexplained primitive attractive forces to maintain the shapes and configurations of those bodies. These attempts usually took inertia for granted as a primitive attribute of matter.
So again, inertia is just this idea that somehow matter has a resistance to change, which it doesn't have. If you put matter in space and make it free and unaffected by something, it moves quite easily. Okay, friction causes things not to move. But there's no inertia. There's no resistance. You have to give something force for it to go, but it's free to go anywhere you want it to go if you give it a force.
Including this inertia, you know, mass concepts, mathematical concepts, that's when they invented these and started working with these concepts instead of working with objects. Why? Because they couldn't see or touch the mediators.
So I don't think either, you know, Descartes or Newton are guilty of this crime, so you shouldn't be using them as examples, because I don't think they were obsessed with mathematizing or formalizing. They were trying to conceptualize. They were trying to imagine mechanisms. It's just not that easy to come up with a mechanism that doesn't have some catastrophic fail aspect.
The same people in other contexts sought to account for inertia and purity relational terms by invoking primitive interactions between what? Material objects.
I mean, all the wrong answers will be proven wrong. So you have to get exactly the right answer. You can't get just like close to the right answer because it's still going to look like the wrong answer. It's like you really do have to get it really right before it really works. A little bit off is a lot off. That's just the fact. That's what makes it difficult. That's why science is hard work.
You have to fall back on material objects. And these people, on the one hand, they had this duality, where on the one hand, they would talk about inertia, mass, force, concepts, maybe energy. And then on the other, they try to simulate them with objects. And you can't put the two together. You either work with objects and say Mother Nature does this with objects, or you start working with all these mathematical concepts, and then, you know, without noticing, you turn them into physical objects, you
It's just silly. I mean, this is kind of just crap, right? Because obviously you can undo both. You can model the objects, you can put right on it 10 kilograms. You can make a model of it, give it a weight, and then make the model move mathematically, and it's going to be correct. So they work together. Math can create simulations.
By these abstractions turned into physical objects, and now you say, oh, the force, oh, the energy, mass, move this way, weight went upwards. So this is where they got into trouble, because they started using all these concepts and turning them into physical objects, and they thought that by doing so they are
physical objects. Light is still a concept, okay? We're still debating it, so it's still just a concept. It's still just a thing that happens, and we can make declarations about it, all right? So, you know, but When do we say, how do you define when somebody has a theory of light that's right? Well, you define that by how perfectly it explains all the circumstances that we've seen light in, and it does exactly what, so it's simulating it, really. Once you simulate it with some basic mechanical mechanism as the underlying cause of the mechanism, you know, the action, then you win.
We're giving you a physical interpretation. And today they have this duality again. They say, we explained it. Did you really explain it? Oh, we describe it, and science is about describing. So is it about describing or about explaining? And that's where the problem is. These people don't explain. And only when someone puts them against the wall and starts pummeling them, they say...
It doesn't matter. Their descriptions, whether they are explanations or not, it doesn't matter, because the explanation is itself, he did it. Because why? Because... it's not an answer. They didn't answer the first question, let alone the seventh question.
Well, no, we haven't explained it, but that's philosophy anyways, because we don't know what's in that invisible world anyways. That's their answer, right? Okay, so what happens? It turns out that Newton's ghost followed all the way to the 20th century to Mr. Einstein, who tried to figure out...
All right, so we'll quit there, just because he cut out 200 years. All right, so 200 years of physics just got thrown away. They're very significant 200 years. All of the Bohr crap, lots of stuff going on. But I mean, the whole period of time where they're trying to figure out, go from the fact that they wrote a wrong theory of energy, and I could just argue that that led to all of this catastrophe, because again, it's in Einstein's own equations, the squaring of the speed of light as somehow being overtly connected to some elemental energy of matter, where the elementary energy of matter isn't, why would it be the square of the speed of light? I mean, it's a silly thing to say that's how much energy it in a way he's saying how much energy does it take to move an electron or to keep an electron in an atom. The portion of energy, if I release that electron from the atom, what amount of energy is released to the universe? Because now I'm not moving it anymore. I move it one last time and then stop it. So now it's no longer connected to any other thing. It's not jiggling anymore. So it's not absorbing. Well, see, it can never do that. I can never take it out of the universe as an entity. It's always jiggling. No matter what I put in an atom or I take it out of the atom, it's still being jiggled by the force. So that's the problem. It's always moving. So until I just crush it, if I crush an electron, what have I done to the universe? That's the key. All right, yeah, I'll draw this one just because this is the key takeaway. All right. So the electron, just by existing, it, you know, and the proof of the proton also, right? So just by existing, it's moving from here to here, right? Because there's just happens to be one more little force element comes from this direction than from this direction. All right. So at any one minute, there's a little bit, you know, a sun blew up over here 4 billion years ago, and all of a sudden there's one less photon on this side than there's on this side, right? I mean, one less little piece of energy. So constantly the electron is doing this and this and this and this and this and this, right? Every single one of those lines, okay, every time it goes from this place to this place, it's using a piece of force. So the piece of force has to push it, push, 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 push. And the speed the electron went to go from here to here is much less than the speed of light, right? So it's much less than the speed of light. So it's the force was going the speed of light. It slowed down. So the force would have been here, all right? If it wasn't pushing the matter, the force would have gotten here. So you can sort of understand that if I did this, like if I took this electron out of the universe, then this force would be here. This force bit would be here. This force bit over here would be here. Everything would be further along. So there would be more energy in the universe. There would be more, all these bits of force that were slowed down pushing this matter, they would get somewhere sooner. And hitting something sooner is the same thing as having more energy. Arriving early is more energy than arriving late, right? So that would mean the universe has more of this in it. There's more lines traveled, more distance traveled by the force if it doesn't hit matter. So if I pull matter out, Einstein's theory is saying essentially it's equal to this much of an increase in force in the universe. Universe is that much more energetic by taking the dull motion consuming material objects out of the universe. I pull all the matter out of the universe, right? The force is really going places. You know, time is now, we're way ahead, okay, in terms of everything happens much faster. So that's the connection to time. It's not a direct connection. It's just a consequential direction that if you increase the energy, you shorten the time. Okay. I can only reason with you. That to me is a good explanation. That's what a good explanation looks like. You know, nice and mechanical. Right to the point, okay. Bent space, not a good explanation. All right, so anyway, enough of the video and such. So, till the next time, this has been the draftphysics.com video presentation. And, you know, I like Bill, but he's an asshole. I mean, he's just an asshole. Ugh, shit.